राधिकाय ठडालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। श्री सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय। श्री श्री गौर गदाधर जी की जय। श्री महाशिवरात्रि की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो ग्रीटिंग्स ऑल ऑफ यू फ्रॉम श्याम आश्रम। आई एम हियर स्टिल इन काली फॉर द टू मोर डेज, टुडे एंड टुमारो एंड मंडे वेरी अर्ली इन द मॉर्निंग। आई एम लीविंग टूवर्ड the airport, and I have a few flights till finally arriving to Alachua and staying in the US for a few months. So everything has been nice this week. It was a little bit more quieter and more quiet. I've been a little sick these last days. Nothing extreme, but I don't know, some fever 2 days ago. I'm still recovering. I'm not 108%. Probably I'm never in my 108% in terms of health, but in my usual standard. But I'm good enough as to make this meeting today, and I have another meeting later today. You may notice my voice is not so powerful. I've been a few 2-3 days resting, but it was good. I mean, restoration and productivity are complementary in our life, sadhakas, and even sickness has to be integrated into the equation, and sickness is not only just to get cured off and continue. No, it comes with a purpose, and it's some visitor. And Atiti Devo Bhavan, says Shastra, we are to receive an uninvited guest as if it were God himself. So this was quite unexpected, but fortunately it came during a few days where I have no programs, so I had a few free days to rest, and I feel better today and hopefully tomorrow, whatever it has to happen. So there has been more quieter days here, sharing a little bit with the devotees and continuing to work on the project of my next book. I think I already told you about that. I'm thinking about writing a whole book on the principle of how reality is is ever evolving, basically. How everything is in a state of constant growth and expansion, and how to, if we adopt that viewpoint, if you understand how reality operates from that perspective, how that can also be a game-changing view, such as it is so many other stances that can really change our way of experiencing life. Like we were talking the last years or so about unconditional love and how to enter into that space of realizing how Krishna is loving us unconditionally can really change the way we address not only our sadhana but everything. So and that will deserve its own separate book, which probably will come after this one. But this one, for me, it's also very important to understand God is not a static, fixed person, but he's in ever-evolving mood. He's growing in love. I mean, he's always God. It's not that he becomes someone else or less than him. But in the experience of love, God becomes ever fresh and ever new, as scriptures describe him. And love is ever fresh and ever new. And therefore, our own potential as souls in connection with God and love is potentially ever fresh and ever new. And by extension, everything in existence somehow inherits that DNA. So it's very important that we enter into that space where we perceive reality, when we conceive and experience things like a constant movement and growth towards something more eternally, not reaching a final point where there's no further perfection, no further development, and so on. So anyhow, I don't want to make a full spoiler of the book, but that's what I'm working on at present. And I finished half of the book already, at least the basic first draft, so to say. Let's see what happens after it goes through the filter of peer reviewers and editors and like-minded friends who will be ruthless as a critic. I need that feedback for sure. But those have been the news during this week. And of course, the news pertaining to this particular day is that we are celebrating Mahashivaratri. So I was planning to share a few words about it, unless some of those three raised hands are have to do with asking me to talk about it. Because if so, we will make it even more nice with you asking about it. But if not, I just can talk about it. Back to Ras, you are raising your hand.
Yes, Maharaj. I'm
Yes.
having trouble getting onto Facebook, streaming onto Facebook. I have made you a co-host. Can you see if you can get on to Dotmia? Under
Let's
the
see.
three, under the more, live on
There the
Facebook.
more. No, I don't have any option of for streaming. It's okay.
Okay.
Life happens.
Yes, it does.
Later we can share the I'm streaming via Instagram just in case, and we'll just share the link of YouTube later in Facebook or something.
I can see it on Facebook.
So, going back to the topic, so those three raised Sumati and Utamchit and Rastangi, I think three. You cannot listen to
Maharaj,
me
you were
now?
not. Yeah, now you're audible. Otherwise, your voice was breaking.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So let me know if you can you stop hearing me again. I don't know why. Hopefully this live streaming through Instagram is not consuming too much of the local Wi-Fi for the Zoom meeting. If not, I may have to stop that. So can you hear me now?
Yes, Maharaj.
But normally, or it's like stopped and interrupted or something like that.
It's fine now, Maharaj. It's
Okay.
uninterrupted.
So those three, okay, the three hands you have raised have nothing to do with Shivaratri this time. Just for me to share some introductory words
No, mine
on
does
that,
not.
and then we can go to your specific questions. Okay. Just to honor the particular occasion, of course. We can go in so many directions while talking about Shiva, Mahadev. It's a quite complex tattva, like Guru tattva is. Generally, our acharyas will say that if there are two most difficult tattvas are Guru tattva and Shiva tattva, which means they are very difficult to understand and they are very easy to misunderstand before. So we cannot go into the details and intricacies of it now, but just a few words to try to honor Shiva Tattva Mahadev and Shivaratri, Mahashivaratri, which basically Mahashivaratri is not the appearance day of Shiva because technically speaking, Shiva does not have an appearance day. You will never hear about Shiva's father or mother, although somehow in the Bhagavatam we have this story that Shiva is manifesting through the nostrils of Brahma. If you want to call that a birth, at the same time, Shiva is an eternal truth in the same way. And he's not so much like being born on earth. Let's say, like Le Krishna performs his Leela and he's being born and he's growing, learning to crawl and gradually growing, basically. He's born a Leela. We never heard about Shiva being a child, so a baby, so to say, and performing Kumar Leela and so on. So Shivaratri has more to do always the Shiva day on during the year, so to say, like what will be for us Janmashtami or Gaur Purnim. Shivaratri in itself, it's more a celebration. There are different explanations of that. What do we actually celebrate on Shivaratri, or maybe the question will be better. The ask is, it's not so much what we are celebrating, but who we are celebrating, despite the what. And we are celebrating Shiva. But in the what part of the question, sometimes it said today the celebration has to do with Shiva's marriage to Parvati. So today is that celebrated, but also it has been said that on Shivaratri, it is celebrating the day that Shiva took the form of the Lingam, Shiva Lingam. And also it is described that on Shivaratri, we celebrate the day that Shiva or Mahadev drank the poison from the churning of the ocean as described in the Bhagavatam. So I just want to share a few words before going to our questions regarding this last point, which is connected to the description of the Bhagavatam, since Gaudiya Vaishnavas will describe Shiva or other tattvas as the Bhagavatam has presented them, because there are different narratives and perspectives given in the different Puranas, as we know, and the different scriptures, which are also focused on different audiences in many cases. So for us, the Bhagavatam, the Amala Purana, is giving us like the Nirguna or transcendental perspective of things, including Shiva. And of course, Shiva there has been famously described as Vaishnavanam Jatashambhu, or the greatest of all Vaishnavas. So also we will address Mahadeva's great... There's one possibility of addressing Shiva Tattva is Shiva is the greatest devotee, and we'll pray for him to be not the greatest devotees, because we will never be that, but to follow into their footsteps and serve the greatest devotees. So in connection to also some section of the Bhagavatam, there's the description of the drinking of the poison from the ocean, the churning of the ocean, which is a high... This isn't 8th canto, I think, starting 7th chapter, or maybe 6th chapter. The drinking of the poison is 7th chapter. And it's a highly, I will say, symbolic section. What's the meaning of the churning of the ocean? The ingredient come as a result. And if you pay attention, you can draw lots of archetypal. It's cutting out again. Well, I will stop the live stream in Instagram there. I'm sorry for those there. You can connect next time to YouTube to see if it's helping for the streaming here now. So let's see. Okay, can you hear me now? Yes? Okay, I've stopped the streaming. So let's see if that helps. Let me know at the end of the day if it's helping. And okay. So for the next time, I know what to do. But that's the only thing I can do, because I don't have any other option here. The churning of the ocean is a highly symbolic section of the Bhagavatam, where the ultimate goal that the acharyas have described is symbology, the ultimate nectar that comes from the churning is prem, divine love, and the churning in itself represents the practice, our effort in sadhana, and all the things that may come as a result of that churning. All sadhana is like a churning. You start practicing, you start chanting, whatever you're doing, your sadhana is like starting to churn, starting to move, to explore, to go deeper, to agitate, technically invoking new influences, new grace, new shelter. Things start to move and to churn and to evolve. So different things come as a result of that. And the first thing that comes, the Bhagavatam properly describes, is poison. Interestingly, the first element of the churning is basically you are confronted with certain things that you are not looking at. Like shadow work, as we talk in radical personalism, Mahaprabhu will say, Chitta Darpana Marjanam. No, you start to clean the mirror of your subconscious, and some of that dust comes from the subconscious layer goes to the conscious layer, and you're able to see it. You're able to become aware of things that you are not aware, and they are not the most glorious, so to say, and you need to address them, identify them, while not identifying with them. So, well, the point is that, in brief, the Bhagavatam described that poison described there as Kalakutwar was threatening to kill everyone and the whole universe. Probably trying to describe how we may subjectively feel when we are confronted with our own anarthas. And we have to admit that to ourselves. That may seem like universal devastation or something. That's the most painful thing, no? That we have to admit some of those things to ourselves. So at that point is that Shiva appears on stage, so to say, and he drinks the poison that was about to kill everyone, and he keeps the poison on his throat without swallowing it fully, just keeps it on his throat, and that poison ornaments his throat. It makes his throat bluish, and therefore he receives the name Nilakanta, which means he of the blue throat. So here the acharya is described, Mahadev here is representing Guru Tattva. He's showing the perfect example of a guru. A guru in the sense of the guru is taking the poison, dealing with the poison, if you want to continue with the analogy of the disciple, he's coexisting with the anarthas, the disciple, and him or her in that, without becoming overwhelmed and over-identified with that to the point that the guru himself become affected by that, so to say. But he or she, the guru, deals with that poison, quote unquote, in such a way that it becomes an ornament. Like when we know sometimes in some medicines also come from something that is poisonous. But when you know how to engage with that poisonous substance in a proper way, that becomes healing. So that's the same principle here. Whatever we may deem as poisonous at present, if properly engaged with, that can end up in healing and highlighting, in this case, the compassion of the principle of Sri Guru. So Mahadev Shiva is praised in the Bhagavatam not only as the greatest Vaishnava, but also as a very unique representative of Guru Tattva, who knows his own adhikar and can deal with certain situations that not everyone can deal. That's why at the end of the Bhagavatam, at the end of the Rasa Lila, when Parikshit Maharaj is asking Sukadev Goswami how it is that Krishna, the prince of Dharma, was engaging in dance with so many, for to give Sukadev Goswami the chance to say some words, so to further clarify the end of the Rasa Lila, this is not something ordinary. And then Sukadev Goswami gives again the example of Mahadev, saying he was able to drink an ocean of poison and he became ornamented, but who can do that? No? So like implying, even if you are playing the role of a guru, you have to know how much you can deal with whatever situation you are dealing as a guru. Because there are degrees of that, and you have to deal with poison, or whatever word you want to use, to deal with your circumstances you are supposed to help in such a way that you are not drowning in them. So as the Bhagavatam says, Sui Sui Kari Janista Saguna Parikirtita. To acknowledge your adhikar, to acknowledge your eligibility, your capabilities or incapabilities to when performing anything, that's real virtue, that's real beauty. And this includes, of course, the guru department. So anyhow, that's what came to mind in connection to Mahadev today. Of course, we can highlight and glorify Shiva from so many different angles. I just concentrated for a few minutes on this. I didn't want to go further than that, since we have some questions, but just wanting to honor the situation we are celebrating today. Shri Mahashivaratri Ki Jai. So that's it. Let's go to the raised hands and we'll begin with Sumati. She's first in the queue. So Sumati, you can unmute yourself.
And yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. My question, I think, is a little bit tied into what you were speaking about before you started speaking about Lord Shiva. But
oh,
it's
really?
About it in the beginning of your chapter in Radical Personalism on Individuation, you're talking about the necessity of the human experience in order to really develop as fully human and fully divine. And you say that our sadhaka deha, or practitioners' physical and psychic bodies, our humanity, can become fully spiritualized to the point of accompanying us in eternity. So I'm just, and I know you give the example of Dhruva Maharaj, and you speak of how the saintly person is not cremated, but buried because his body is considered completely spiritualized. So I'm just, you know, I'm a visual person, and somehow I can't imagine like the body of an old, like let's say Srila Prabhupada, he's buried in his body, but it wouldn't be that body that he would be serving or Mahaprabhu or Radha and Krishna. I wonder if you could explain that in a way that I can hopefully understand it.
The last minute, your audio got interrupted. So can you just repeat after you mentioned Srila Prabhupada?
Yeah, like, so
what's
Srila
the
Prabhupada,
question? Yeah.
How is it that a completely spiritualized sadhaka deha enters into Gaura Lila or Krishna Lila in the same self body? That's
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question. And that has been asked a few times by devotees who have read the book, which of course I can understand. You can unmute yourself, Sumati. Because it makes sense that some may ask this question, but not this exact same body I'm in, because you can see that matter decomposes after the Atma leaves the body, so it's not literally this same body, right? So no, I'm not referring to that. I try to clarify that in throughout that chapter. I mean, that's not the only time I'm referring to that in that chapter. I mean, I'm trying to see here if I have another quotation in that connection. But anyhow, it may not be possible to find it now. But my main point is, of course, I quoted the example of Dhruva Maharaj, which of course is more kind of an exception to the rule. It's pretty extraordinary how that happened. So I'm not saying we should all expect that the exact same thing happened to us, because probably not. So what I mostly try to make, the point I try to make, and again, I quoted Shastra and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport on one section on Rasa Lila, when he's saying that one can fully spiritualize one's sadhaka deha. So one may have been born with this body, and this body may have technically considered not a sadhaka deha. One may have not been born as a sadhaka, and this body may have not been totally imbued with bhakti samskars. But in time, that material energy became exposed to the influence of bhakti to such a degree that, yes, we could technically say that body is totally spiritual. Of course, that's important, the point, important point to make. And that's why the body of a pure devotee is venerated and worshipped, and the paraphernalia of that person, as we all know, because the assumption is that body is fully spiritualized, right? So I hope we agree with that as a foundational point. But yeah, also we have the point that the body, the soul leaves that body eventually. So, and the body is whether cremated or put into samadhi, generally into samadhi. But again, there are cases of cremation as well, depending the case, the situation. So still we see that body there, let's say, that body remains. If you put the body into samadhi, somehow it's preserved with salt and all this stuff, but it doesn't mean that that pure devotee is trapped below the earth in that fully spiritualized body and cannot be in the spiritual world at the same time or something. It has to make the point that in a spiritual, how to say, in a spiritual body, which is basically identical in one sense, or resembles, if you want to use that word, that body that the sadhaka had, that person is serving eternally in the lila. So there is a corresponding, and this is a long topic. I've tried to explain some of the things in my first book also. I wrote, again, of course, you are quoting radical personalism, but in my first book, Inherent or Inherited, there is a whole chapter on the siddha deha, or the spiritual body. So we talked about that there, implying that it's not that the siddha deha is, once siddha deha in eternity is hanging out in a closet, so to say, like a suit. Okay, not waiting for you already. It's not like that, technically. At least that's not my take. Of course, some others may have that opinion, but we don't find that kind of description. So it's more, I will say, it's more like if in its if one's progressive journey, the soul in bhakti, the soul in one's progressive journey in bhakti eventually becomes exposed to bhakti to a point that such devotee, his or her body becomes fully spiritualized, that manifests in the eternal, in the spiritual world, a replica, if you want to use that word. And again, words are words. No, so what we are talking about is way beyond words. We are trying to say something, but please remind that you can never trap the experience of transcendent in mere words. So whenever one particular devotee in this lifetime, let's give an example, attains full perfection and the body is fully spiritualized, that invokes in transcendence, in what we may call the potential of the Swarup Shakti. We have a potential as invokes in the potential of the Swarup Shakti, a new body that fully resembles that spiritualized body that the sadhak has on earth. And that body will correspond with the, of course, with the corresponding age that the body will be serving in during the lila, which is a young age. So to give the example you gave, it's Srila Prabhupada. If you want to consider Srila Prabhupada as a sadhana siddha, one could say, okay, Prabhupada in that particular lifetime attained full perfection, and when and the sadhaka deha was fully spiritualized, a corresponding version of it in Golok manifested according to him as being a young person, so to say, in the age corresponding to the age one will be serving in Lila, 12, 13 years or so. So that will be the explanation. So I'm not saying that literally this self same body is carried there and so on, but you will find a body that will be, I don't want to say identical in every sense, but quite resembling to the point of somehow describing it as a replica. And while the material body here is no longer material because it has been fully spiritualized, so in that sense remains venerable for us, and that's why we somehow worship it. Like if you, I don't know, if I give you a pen and you will tell me, okay, thank you for the gift, Maharaj. But if I tell you, well, but actually this pen was the one that was used by Srila Prabhupada when writing this letter to this devotee, and for you, immediately it becomes something else. It's no longer a pen. It's no longer a material pen. But you ascribe to this material element a whole another dimension of spiritual influence, and it's okay. So you follow my point. So the same, I'm giving the example of a pen, but extend the same example to a body, which even this pen at one point will disappear, technically, and not disappear, but will dismantle and take another form. Material energy doesn't disappear. It just mutates from one form to another. So this fully spiritualized pen will dismantle and take another form. As long as it's there, we are worshiping that and venerating that. So in the same way, you can have a buried, fully spiritualized, quote-unquote, material body, and we venerate that, despite we acknowledge that person who we are worshiping, so to say, there has a corresponding spiritual body, and he or she's serving in the Lila in that body, which resembles the body that that person has as a sadhaka. So I don't know if that helps, Samati.
That helps a lot. And yes, thank you so much for that explanation. And that's what I meant by, it kind of goes, you were, before you started talking about Shiva Devi, you were talking about the evolution, and then we're constantly evolving mode. So, and I would imagine the spiritualized body moving on has to do with the mood of the devotee and their desire to serve Krishna in a particular way.
Yeah, again, there is so much more to say about that.
Yeah.
I'm becoming tempted to go there, but there are a few hands raised.
But
I
thank
will
you.
Mention two words, only two words. For example, in relation to one's spiritual body or spiritual identity ever evolving, a few things. One that I mentioned before, there is Vyasatasta Shakti has had potential. And also, the other Shaktis have potential as well, because every Shakti by definition means energy or means potency. No? Energy, potency, synonymous. And every potency has potential. I mean, the word potential is tied with potency. You cannot speak about a potency without potential. So potential means something else you can become in the context of what you are. So we as Tathasta Shakti are something already, but have a potential of becoming more on the basis of what we are. Similarly, matter has some potential, and Swarup Shakti, the internal energy of Bhagavan, has some potential. And that creates further unfoldings, that creates new situations, new lila on a daily basis. It's not that everything is fixed in Golok Vrindavan and nothing new can happen. That will be hell. Imagine you arrive to Golok Vrindavan and there you are and there are no news. It's always the same, fixed, no change, no evolving, no developing, no unfolding. That doesn't sound like heaven. So there has to be a potential that allows for the unfolding of new experiences, of new lilas, and of new spiritual bodies, of new people arriving there, so to say. Although paradoxically, the experience of someone arriving there is not so much like, oh, I arrived here today, I was not here yesterday, and you have a welcome party or something. No, the experience is, I've always belonged here. That will be the subjective experience, which doesn't mean we are always here and we fell from Golok. I'm not suggesting that, just in case, but that will be the subjective experience, kind of how it's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopa Kumar reaches Golok. And in that connection, it's interesting because Brihad Bhagavatamrita as well, in connection to the spiritual bodies being ever evolving, first Gopa Kumar is in Vaikuntha, he describes something very interesting. He says that according to the need of service, sometimes the Vaikuntha inhabitants will take different bodies. Will take a body of a bird, of an animal, of a human, different forms, according to serving the needs of Narayan, so to say, or the needs of service at the moment. Although we generally will think, hey, Vaikuntha Vasis are forearm, has this particular shape, similar to Narayan, at least some of them, those who attain Sarupya Mukti. But interestingly, Sanatana Goswami adds that layer of complexity in describing them sometimes taking a form of whatever, a dog, a pigeon. But that's not the case in Vrindavan. That's my point also. In Vrindavan, we don't hear that the Brajavasis are transforming, so to say, into other species to serve Krishna, which doesn't mean that they are not transforming. Of course, again, they are transforming their hearts. No, their love is increasing. Their increased love is adapting to the need of service of the moment in the Leela. And in one sense, one could say their bodies are transforming. Sometimes we hear this word bodily transformations that we ascribe to trembling and crying and so on. But also, we could say, in one sense, literally, they are transforming. I mean, not transforming from a gopi to a gopa, from a girl to an old person, not in that sense. But understand that the bodies in the Leela are spiritual bodies. I know this may be complex to grasp in our heads, but try to follow the simple logic. The bodies that people have in the Leela are spiritual bodies. So, as I explained in the chapter on Siddha Deha in my first book, a spiritual body means a body made of Swarup Shakti, made of the intrinsic energy of Bhagavan, not made of other substance. It's made of love, let's say. You have a body made of love. And love is ever evolving, as we already mentioned, and that's mentioned in Shastra. Love is always growing and expanding, and it gives full satisfaction, but at the same time, it creates a new level of thirst that we may call divine dissatisfaction that can always grow exponentially forever. So you have a spiritual body, and the spiritual body literally is made of love, because spiritual body means body made of Swarup Shakti, which is another word for love. And your body and your soul, in one sense, become one. No? In Golok Vrindavan, you are not making too much difference between soul and body. So you acquire an identity of love, and the body is made of love, and love is ever evolving. Therefore, the body made of love is ever evolving. So in that sense, I'm saying the body will change. The spiritual body undergoes some form of evolution permanently. Doesn't mean you abandon your eternal identity with this name, with this service, with this color of sari or turban, whatever your position of service. That's not changing. But despite that's not changing, everything else is changing, so to say, in terms of the experience of love. Just I'm saying all this, I know I may be disturbing you, unsettling you by saying all this stuff. But just for us to not get too much of a static idea of how everything looks like in eternity. Now I have my given identity, sari color and name and service. Everything is in order. Everything is fixed. Everything is predictable. There's no more change. That's not what reality is about. That's not what God is about, what love is about, what Golok is about, what we are about. So, just want to make that point clear and complementary addition to your questions, Sumati. So thank you for that, and sorry for creating any confusion with my statements in my book. That can happen. Okay.
I'm glad it gave me an opportunity to ask that, and you could speak. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Thank you. So, who's next? I don't know if Zoom is showing. I mean, we have three more. I see three hands, but I don't know if Zoom shows the three hands in order as they were raised, or they were put like alphabetically or whatever. I don't want to be
There,
unfair with the raisers of the hands.
they're in order of when they raise their hand.
Okay, so let's respect the protocol and continue with Anuttam Chitra then.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my doubt, I had recently heard this class of yours on radical remark, and you were sort of unpacking how a radical remark or a constructive feedback is different from Vaishnava Praal, then in what spirit and how such a remark needs to be made or a feedback needs to be given. So I was thinking of this pastime of Rup Goswami, who was meditating, he was in Samadhi, and he was having the vision of the divine couple. And then there is a Vrajvasi who happens to pass by, and seeing Rup Goswami sort of smile or laugh at whatever is happening in the Leela, he sort of mistakes it to be some form of ridicule of himself. And that leads to the disappearance of the vision of the divine couple. Like, suddenly he comes out of that state and he's confused. So is there a potential of aparadh even in a constructive feedback, where it may not be the person that's giving the feedback that might be the stakeholder, but rather the person on the receiving end? Because from this pastime, to me, that is what it seems like. Of course, later, Goswami had the opportunity to resolve and process, clarify all those misconceptions with the Vrajvasi. But then I wanted to know, is there a possibility of an offense? Because this is happening without the knowledge of the person who's giving. I have no idea as to what somebody else might be thinking. Like, even if I, let's say, apologize to them in the process of giving a feedback, they may say that, yeah, I'm okay, I'm fine. But then what if they are not fine? And would that sort of still count as an aparadh?
Yeah, thank you. So where to begin? And how to deal with all that without neurosis? Because, I mean, you can be creating, making others feel offended at every single step, and you may not have full time first to become aware of who they were, what to speak of, begging forgiveness, and what if, and the question is, in some cases, I may not need to beg forgiveness. That's the point. No? Like, for example, and I'm going back to Rupa Goswami's situation for in a minute. Let's say, because sometimes we confuse humility with so many other things. And so some may think, okay, if someone feels offended by you, you should beg forgiveness. But what if the person feels offended because I'm trying to tell the truth? No, so I should I apologize for trying to live a life aligned with truth? I don't think so. No, that goes against my principles to say, excuse me, but I apologize for trying to say, tell the truth and trying to live according to truth. I mean, what I will say, I promise I won't do it again. What you will say? I mean, you follow my point. So the criterion to follow in this case has to do with something. In general, I'm talking the general rule, and it has to be something real going on, something real that I've done wrong, and I really need to apologize for, because humility is not just apologize even for something you don't know about it. I mean, you don't know what you did, but apologize for that. It's like, that won't be a very deep apology. It has to be felt. It's not just beg forgiveness there. Why? Just beg forgiveness there. You will do it, but that's not genuine. That's not authentic. So what's that creating? Probably a Niyama Graha mentality of doing things without understanding why. So going to Rupa Goswami's Leela, that particular instance, first I'd like to clarify that that's discussed. So to say, that's not all Gaudiya Vaishnavas agree that that's something that actually happened. Because you don't find, I mean, that may belong to some oral tradition, but we don't find that Leela described anywhere in the main books where we know of from Rupa Goswami's life, like Chaitanya Charitamrita and other books, when we get to know from the Goswamis. So I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying this is there. So one option will be for those who say that's not real to just dismiss that whole thing immediately because they think that didn't happen, or we don't have any particular confirmation. Another option, if we consider, okay, that's real, which again, we don't have a way to prove that, let's be honest. Again, it's not in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sometimes, of course, I'm sure you and most of us heard about that from someone else. Probably if you ask that person where you learned this, they will say, I heard it from someone else. And if you continue that, they will continue saying like that, which I'm not criticizing that, but there is no like converging point into some like unanimous Shastric source, so to say, in this particular case. Which again, it's okay. Some of those things may be and happen like that. It's okay. So if we take this situation as real, which I don't have any problem in taking it, then the question comes, as you mentioned, you know, like, okay, Rupa Goswami was in deep samadhi. He's Rupa Goswami. He's Rupa Goswami. He cannot offend anyone. I mean, he's a well-wisher of everyone, like Srinivas Acharya sings in the Sat Goswami Astakam. I mean, the six Goswamis are like a blessing for planet Earth and well-wishers of everyone, oceans of compassion. So how will he, of course, bully on a handicapped person? Like, no? Like the other person took it as such. No, it's not possible. But he was witnessing some very parihas-like, very joyful and funny lila in his inner contemplation. He laughed, and this person took offense. So I think this is an important point that in connection to how we use the word offense. Generally, in English, when you use offense, you will speak about someone took offense. Generally, you don't say someone gave offense. So I'm saying this because aparad is more related to what you do and not so much to how other people feel in connection to you, so to say. So I'm saying that why? Because technically speaking, following this idea of how we use offense, the word offense is not a proper translation for aparad. You follow my point? Because offense is has something more with I take offense. But aparad has more to do with offending, quote unquote, other people, even if they take offense or not. You can do aparad to other people, and it doesn't mean that the other people felt, took offense. But you engage in aparad. You follow. I may engage in aparad toward a pure devotee, and due to her purity, they won't take offense. But it doesn't mean that I have not committed aparad. You follow my point. And it can happen the opposite. You may not do any aparad, and the person is taking offense. But that's not aparad. That's someone else taking offense. That said, for me, the main principle, the main teaching of this lila is, despite Rupa Goswami did no aparad, but this handicapped person took offense, Rupa Goswami somehow or other, I will say that's more like a lila, more like a point to making how someone like Rupa Goswami, who is such an ocean of compassion, that even if someone took offense despite him not committing aparad, he was willing to harmonize that, to calm that person, even to beg forgiveness in his extreme level of humility, which we cannot imitate. I don't think that will be healthy for us. In other words, I don't know, if someone tells you, Anuttam Chitra, I feel deeply offended by you wearing glasses. I feel deeply offended by you wearing like a green dress today. I feel really offended. So what you will do there, as I say before, no? I mean, you have to keep your sanity together, put yourself, I mean, and imagine that 108 people tell you the exact same thing, which it's pretty usual in social media nowadays. Someone doesn't like any detail about you, and it's just like a stream of stuff. And we cannot just I mean, to be a non-offensive devotee doesn't mean that I have to, like, to, how to say, like, to satisfy every single person on earth that chooses to, whatever, to have their own opinions formed on me from the distance, to feel offended by me, I don't know, not having visibility like here now, whatever the case, right? So that's not necessarily I'm being an aparadi and I need to appease every single person, because if not, I'm an aparadi, an offender. So I think mostly that this Lila of Rupa Goswami has more to do with highlighting his heightened sensibility and his pure devotion that takes him to not. Yeah. I cannot tell you what's going on in the heart of Rupa Goswami at that moment. It would be too much for me to say that. One could say maybe he did that, if that actually happened, maybe he did that to appease the other person that he knew was in anxiety while knowing he didn't commit an offense. But also due to his heightened humility, he felt, maybe I don't know what I did, but something I did that disturbed that person, and I don't want to be a cause of disturbance. Again, it's very intimate, personal, subjective. I cannot give you a final conclusion of why 100% Rupa Goswami did what he did. But I think that to apply that to our situation, we should say, yeah, we shouldn't go neurotic, and we should pay attention to what's our intention. Aparad basically means, instead of translating that as offense, that as we showed, it may not be fully accurate. Aparad means that which goes against love. Aparad, to attack love, to go against love, to attack bhakti, to bite the hand that is feeding you, and so on. So, because if not, we can, as mentioned in my book, and I won't go there into detail, but we can weaponize the idea of aparad endlessly and create fear, intimidation, cancel culture, silencing in every possible direction, because we don't want to be offensive. We don't want our bhajan to be disturbed by the disruption of aparad. So because we don't want that, better don't say anything. Even if it's not offensive, who knows? Just in case, let better be cautious and keep absolute silence, which may end up being a form of aparad, a form of hypocrisy, a form of silent witnessing of abuse, a form of being a co-host for things that are not healthy, that go against law. So again, there are so many possible ways for these different scenarios to play out. I remember when I published my first book, a good number of devotees considered that I was being aparadi by doing that, or offensive. And probably a few still think that. I'm sorry for that, sincerely. It was not my intention to to create that. But for some of them, the main point was like, well, because you are sharing this, some people is being disturbed in their faith, and therefore you are disturbing their faith, and therefore you're an aparadi. Basically, that was kind of the sequence. And of course, I won't go into the details. I talk about this many times. But first question is, if someone is being disturbed by my book or by anything, if someone's face is being disturbed, the question is why? Because why? It's because of for proper reasons, or for reasons, no? Your faith may be may need to be disturbed on some level to grow, to go deeper. Or maybe you are disturbed because you are reading something that is not up to your mark. You are not ready to read and you should stop reading, but you continue reading and it's disturbing you. But it has nothing to do with the intention of the author trying to disturb you, or with the content of the book meant to disturb you. It's just you may not be ready for that yet, and it's okay. But it has nothing to do with aparad and trying to disturb others. It just, you picked the wrong book. Something like that. No, you listen from the wrong person. Not that the person or the book was wrong. It just was not the proper match for the time being. And I remember someone say some things you mentioned, and of course sometimes say people have been disturbed, and I ask, so what's that? Which are those people? Because sometimes these accusations come like in plural, like many devotees have been like, can you name? Can you tell me? And there's never a list of that. So sometimes that's just speaking for the person throwing the accusation. Although I don't want to deny that some others may have been disturbed, but also my point is, okay, in my book, I try to quote Shastra, and our Shraddha or our faith has to be Shastriya Shraddha, according to Rupa Goswami, faith nourished by scripture. So if our faith has to be Shastriya, scriptural faith, and by me quoting scripture, your faith is disturbed, then which type of faith do you have? Follow. You are supposed to have faith in scripture, and I quote scripture, and your faith is disturbed. So that speaks more about your faith than what I'm quoting. It means that sometimes we are building upon a faith which is not sustained in scripture, but is more sustained of whatever, a sentimental stance, fanaticism, something more superficial, which I'm not condemning that. It can happen on some stage. And at some stage, that faith may need to be disturbed in a proper way, so to say, so one can grow into a more mature scriptural form of faith and so on. So anyhow, my point with all this is that in those cases, I'm trying, I'm not perfect at all, far from that, in terms of humility or anything, but I also have to keep my sanity. So I'm receiving this type of accusations, and I'm trying to be open, to hear, to listen, to be sincere, but I cannot take, okay, I'm being an operative for doing this, and I'm disturbing the faith of these so many people. Because interesting thing that so many people were writing to me, telling me, oh, your book is giving me so much more faith in our tradition and the Bhakti-vinoda Parivara. So that was even more clear. And I was, okay, some people may be disturbed. I'm not denying that. But so many others are really nourished and inspired. So that shows in itself that it's not that the book in itself is disturbing, pointing to that, therefore aparadi, but it's just depending on who picks the book, someone will be nourished or not. And this goes beyond my book. It goes beyond other, it goes to other books, to listening from some Vaishnavas, to so many things in life that, again, as I say before, we have to ascertain our adhikar and how able we are to deal with that, going back to Shiva, taking poison and being able to use poison to ornament himself. So he took poison and ornamented himself. Some other people may take Shastra and kill themselves. You follow? It's not that Shastra is poison, but if you don't have the adhikar, you may go to some sections of Shastra and they will impact you as poison. Not because they are poison, but because you don't have the capacity to process that content. That may be too much. No? Certain shastra, which are very intimate with very detailed descriptions of the sexual affairs between Radha and Krishna, let's say, you go to a Gita Govinda, that's a very delicate book. Very delicate book. Mahaprabhu heard that the very last stage of his life in Gambira, that's it, with two associates, not openly. But if someone that is not prepared for that in terms of inner realization goes there, they can really be affected terribly. I don't want like to create terror, but it's just there is that caution in the scripture. So anyhow, some thoughts in that connection. I hope that helps, Anutam Chitra. Thank you so much for your question.
Yes, Maharaj, thank you very much.
So let's continue to the with the next one, which is Madhav. He's raising his hand.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I'm from Govardhan. Maharaj, my question is somewhat tied to the previous question. So, like I was just reading this section on radical organization, which you have mentioned in your book. So therein you suggest like sometimes leaders they start cherry picking people based on who is offering more value to their institutional setup and to the entire institution run. So in such situations, we do notice such things happening in our societies. But somewhere we are very close to such people. And they are not, and also they are not doing such things out of any malice or any ill feelings towards anything. It's just how the society is set up. It's just how institutions are set up. So when we are in such situations and we have people who are imposing such standards, who are doing, like, who are engaging in such cherry picking or like discrimination or whatever. So how do we personally deal with such people in the sense that how do we get that out, and what should be our reaction or response to such things when we are also out to those people? And then there is question of aparad also. So how to deal with this?
Yeah, thank you. What immediately comes to mind in connection to some recent event, if you want, is that I remember, not exactly in the same way, but Svetadvip Radhika, the other day, you were asking Deva Madhav Prabhu one question, right? Deva Madhav Prabhu gave a lecture the other day in our Tadatmya platform called From Prem to Politics. And Svetadvip Radhika asks, not exactly the same question, but basically how to, so to say, take action when we see some things that are not working well in our society with our leaders. And Dev Mahaprabhu gave a very nice answer. I will replicate it here now. I'm just sending you to the to the source. You can watch that video, listen to the audio in our Tadatmya platforms. That's one thing. I'll say something myself, but I wanted to refer that to what Dev Mahaprabhu said because it was very nice and practical. And which basically, I mean, I will give you a trailer of that, hopefully not spoiling his answer. But basically say the first thing is what we are doing now, which is finding a platform where we can ask about that, no, to begin with, although it may sound still far from the final solution. I mean, the very fact that you can voice your concern, even if it's in a separate, so to say, circle, at least you can voice your concern. For some people, that is not conceivable because they don't have any other circle to voice that. Whatever circle they have, that's not possible for some reason or another, or they feel it's not possible. No, because many times it's more about what we feel. No, let's be honest. Sometimes it's okay, the environment may have their own ways of doing things, but sometimes we also have our own fears, our own as fears of, again, of not belonging, of, and so on and so forth. And of course, after sharing in a circle where we can voice the concern, we can put that in the air somehow, we can receive some feedback, ideally one can approach those people, especially as you mentioned, if they are close people. Okay, let's express our closeness by being able to talk about this. Now, in a private way, we can have a conversation, because if we cannot have a conversation, then how close we are, you know? And I remember Dev Mahaprabhu say, if that's not possible, then you have to talk with other people who are thinking the same and bring, anyhow, I won't spoil his answer. I'm being tempted to do so. I'll stop there with that. But in regarding my point is, there are societies and societies. I mean, if you're referring to one particular society, also it doesn't mean the whole society works like that. I wouldn't like to think in terms of, okay, that's how it is, and it will be like that forever, because I don't, everything should be conceived, again, in ever-evolving terms. For example, if you were referring to the ISKCON society, again, what's ISKCON? Every people will define it differently. It's not one same thing. It's not one same experience. So we have to be very careful of ourselves not having a fixed idea of, okay, ISKCON is my experience of ISKCON, or ISKCON is my ideas about ISKCON. Probably so, but also much more than that. No, not canceling your own experiences or ideas about it, but it's not that the society is just one thing that only functions in one way, only that thinks in one single way. That could be very dangerously reductionistic. bordering impersonalism. I'm not saying you're doing that, but we have to be careful even in how we express ourselves, how we voice our concerns. We have to be careful of not, in our language, projecting this type of all is one, so to say. And the society is this, the things are being done like that. Like if they are like definitive standards for eternity. Like if you study this, the history of ISKCON, of course, ISKCON didn't begin like that. When Prabhupada went to the West, it was in a certain stage, it took certain shape. After a few years, after another years, took different shape. Now it's taking another shape, and it will continue taking new shapes. It's not a fixed substance, so to say. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. ISKCON is a, if you want to put it like that, no? ISKCON is a flexible substance. You want to use those words. No, let's do not conceive of ISKCON as like a rigid, fixed, a static institution. I mean, some people may like to think like that. That's not my cup of tea. I prefer to think of ISKCON as a fluid, ever-evolving, ongoing, flexible substance. It's Prabhupada's heart. Prabhupada's heart is melted. So if something is melting, it's flowing. It's a melted substance, ongoing, flowing, and increasing, because Prabhupada's heart is ever evolving in love. So we should be able to reflect that ever evolvingness of Prabhupada's melted heart. That's ISKCON for me. Again, each one will have their own definition. So first we need to have our own definition of what we were talking about, and then we will be able to address whatever concerns we have with that idea in mind. Because if we already conclude this is a fixed thing, there's nothing to change, it's always the same, then, and you don't like that, but you conclude that there is no change, then, okay, you choose to remain there, so to say. You follow my point. I'm not saying you have to leave that. I'm just saying if it's more about one's personal responsibility. You follow if I say, this institution is always the same. That thing's in, I'm not saying you are saying that. That thing in this way, and I disagree with that. So the following question is, what you are doing there, or what are you do? Will you like to change? Do you think there can be change? Because if you tell me no, I don't think there can be change. So then why you are there? Of course, hopefully one will say, I think there can be change. That's why I remain here. So then the conversation moves on that level. So whatever situation we see at present is not definitive. And we want to invoke change in things we perceive they are not, let's say, fully representative of Prabhupada's melted heart, to continue with the analogy. And what practical ways to do that again? Let's try to talk. Let's try to also be understanding. According to whatever has been established, there are some cultural things, cultural filters, whether it's in India and other places, things are done in a certain way, some emphasis help to create something else. We have to talk, no? We have to talk and to see how much we can talk, how much we are willing to talk, how much other people is willing to hear, how much we are willing to hear. But I would just recommend that, not to begin by talking, that's going on now already, so congratulations. But of course, this is just part of an ongoing conversation, and then it will be taken to another table, so to say. And not in terms of accusation, as you said, there's no malice. We are not thinking these are bad people. They're trying to ruin everything. This is some big conspiracy theory. No, we are not saying that in this case, but we are just acknowledging the possibility for potential pitfalls that may arise in any genuine, honest endeavor in Krishna consciousness. We may begin something with the utmost best intention, good thinking, but in time that transforms into something else. Not because someone had a bad intention, just how things happen. With different influences and dynamics, So we may need to just sit, talk, and go back to which was the original intention, why we started this, and how that intention can be kept, how we may not lose focus, how the essence can always remain over above the form, how the spirit of the law must be about the letter of the law, so to say. That requires always ongoing conversations, always. It's not that, okay, after 5 years, we can stop talking about this. Now we found the perfect, final, definitive shape to all this stuff. It's not possible because everything is evolving. We already talked about that. Everything is moving. So that requires an ever-evolving realities. That I mentioned that in radical personalism. Reality is ever-evolving. It's already moving. It's ongoing. And therefore, we require ongoing conversations to address ongoing, ever-evolving realities. So we need to promote those talks. If that's not promoted enough, then we have to use our creativity and being sincere and honest. If we are doing that, there's no apparatus. Don't get, let's say, intimidated by that word, if that comes in this context, and it will come probably in some cases, what to do. And we have to try, and in that context, we have to find, our voice, we have to find our circle, we have to find a place, we have to find our place in this society, we have to find our society. We have to find, at the end of the day, things and work on the things in a way that we feel it's working. I'm satisfied. It's aligned with my values. I can thrive here. We have to take responsibility and want to be there. Sorry if I'm not giving any like definitive answer, because in one sense, there is no definitive answer. It's an ongoing conversation. So we need to talk, as simple as that sounds. We need to talk. And sometimes we may need to talk strongly. The mother will reply to that in that way also. No? He composed this Bill of Rights that you can present to the leaders and to ask them if they agree or not with that and so on. That may sound a little bit more confrontational, but in some situations, confrontation may be required, not because I have anything against you, but we are here to serve the truth. So when we feel the truth is being compromised, I'm not willing for that to happen. I prefer to confront you so we preserve truth and we preserve the integrity of our relationship with truth in the center, because if not, it starts becoming something else and I don't want to be part of that. I didn't come to Krishna consciousness for something different from Satyam Param Dhimahi, trying to pursue supreme truth. So yeah, it's important that we keep the, and we remind ourselves how our acharyas behave in this connection and how that happens in eternity. You know, everyone is appreciated, not for the financial contributions, and that creates some form of elitism, but everyone is appreciated for whatever they can give, as much as they can give. Not the famous example of the little animal in the Ram Lila, no? We learn now. Squirrel? Sorry, I'm practicing my vocabulary with you. So, which is, it's bringing some little help with bringing some little stones, and Hanuman is kind of bowling her. And Ramachandra is making the point, no? Like no contribution is insignificant if it's sincerely, it's a sincere contribution to the cause. It will take different shapes. It may take a giant shape or a small shape. Like I was saying the other day, when I referred to Bhakti Hridaya Bon Maharaj, maybe I say that in a Spanish lecture on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's appearance day, that some people will say, well, Prabhupada was totally successful, and Bhakti Hridaya Bon Maharaj and other disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta who went to the West before Prabhupada, were not successful. That for me, with all respect, is not correct, to say the least. Because again, what's the yardstick for measuring success? Just a number? I mean, if Bhaktihridaya Bon Maharaj went there, or whomever, Bhakti Vilas Tirtha Maharaj, Bhakti Pradip Tirtha Maharaj, Bhakti Pradip Tirtha Maharaj, Bhakti Saranga Goswami Maharaj, sorry, not Bhakti Vilas Tirtha Maharaj, if they went to the West with the full desire of pleasing their guru, as they did, then that their campaign was a success. Period. I don't care about the external results on the numbers. If you did something with the sincere heart to please God and your guardians, success. And what to speak, even if as a result of that, one devotee, just one devotee like Sadananda Swami came as a result, whom eventually realized his spiritual body became a pure devotee, then that's success. You follow my point, no? It's not about measuring who gives more, who created the biggest number. That's not how Krishna thinks. So we have to measure all the things to put them in to expose them to Krishna's own psychology, how Krishna is seeing this, not how I'm seeing this. If not, I'm giving my own perspective supreme status, and that's not healthy. So yeah, it's important that we remind us in the community. It's not bad to highlight someone who gave a nice donation. It's okay, of course, provided that that person doesn't think just by giving money, that's enough. Krishna only wants my money. Krishna doesn't care for my money. Patram pushpam phalam toyam. That's what he cares for. Yomi bhakti prayachati bhakti, even if it takes the form of a flower, a leaf, some water. That's what Krishna says in the Gita 9:26. He's not saying, give me $1,000,000 with bhakti. He's saying, give me a drop of water, but please with bhakti. Implying, you give me 10,000 rupees without bhakti, I haven't even saw them. So I think this is basic, foundational, but somehow we can become distracted. And I understand this, there's a whole sequence, big projects, big temple, require donation, maintenance, donators come, we need those donations, we highlight that. But all that can, there is always potential pitfalls in all that. So we have to remind ourselves of keeping the essence, always. The individual is always more important than the institution. So that's what comes now. So I hope that helps. And we'll go to Rasang. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Maharaj, for this. I really like that example of ISKCON as being Prabhupada's melted heart. Actually, meditating on this particular analogy can bring out a lot of wealth for us.
Yeah, now, of course, that's one way to put it. We can say so many things. No? ISKCON means Society for Krishna Consciousness. Krishna Consciousness means Mahaprabhu, or it's a name for Radha, who is conscious of Krishna more than anyone else. So what does a society of that mean? But whatever the example you take, whether it's Sri Radha, whether it's Mahaprabhu, whether it's Prabhupada, all of them have melted hearts. So at the end of the day, the melted heart analogy remains. And again, it's fluid stuff. So to say it's liquid, it's melting, it's flowing, and it's non-stop, non-stuck, it's ever evolving. So yeah, it's important to keep that in mind. Thank you. So let's go to Rasangi. Last question. One second, there's something fell here. Oh. Sorry, here I am.
It's okay.
Let's go with this. Yes.
Pranams, and I hope you feel way better soon. I know you're coming in another flight and so busy, so we'll say, send our blessings for your good health.
Thank you.
I'm studying also with my friends the chapter on individuation, and it's equally blowing my mind as much as the vulnerability chapter, I must say. You know, I highly recommend studying this book. And that's part of my question, but I just wanted to share a couple of very compelling arguments you make for doing the work of healing our emotional and mental bodies and our trauma. where you say, interestingly, a difficulty we often experience while trying to conceive of God as fully human is closely tied to our own difficulty in fully embracing our own humanity. Wow. I mean, that's like a bombshell. You know what I mean? Really, to connect that is something that's standing in the way of my realizing and being able to connect with and love Krishna as he'd like to be loved and served. That's amazing to me. And then the other one is by not allowing ourselves to be who we are, actually are, we're not allowing our conception of Krishna to be like he actually is. Oh my God, that's so profound. Right? So it all comes back to us.
You know, the hopefully ball is not in a narcissistic way, but yeah, somehow or other, that's our realm of choice and decision. No? We have to decide upon us how we choose to do whatever we want to do.
And there's so much hope there. You know, like in the 12 steps also, you know, if we have no control over anything, and I mean, we're powerless in a way, but I do have the ability to do some things. And the things that I can do make all the difference. That gives me some feeling of hopefulness that if I do this work, heal my different subtle bodies and the stuff that's gone on that's blocking the flow towards the divine, I will have a better chance at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'd love to hear you talk about all of these things, but there's another point that I was thinking that I know that some of this stuff is transformational. I mean, this book is transformational, as are some other teachings, of course. It's not just information, it's about transformation, right? And how do we hear in a way? How do we study in a way? How do we take it in a way that we can help that to transform us? You know, I know reflecting and listening, hearing well, and reflecting, and then getting meaning out of it, you said, making some meaningfulness for ourselves. So what do you think helps in that process to help us transform while we're studying or practicing? And what stands in the way of that?
Well, what helps us to bring information, to make information transformation, to make a play of words that I also use, because you can read my book or any book, of course, and many of those may have potentially transformational sections, hopefully, but if we are not willing to be transformed, that will be reduced to mere information. So it has to do first, we have to desire transformation, although it sounds basic, but how willing we are. I'm sorry if today it seems like the theme is ever-evolvingness, but you can imagine I'm writing about that, but transformation has to do with that. No, it means like I can always grow, I can always expand. The prospect in love is never-ending, ever-fresh. So I'm always willing to be further transformed. It's not that, okay, now I'm a sannyasi, so I don't need to be transformed. I'm already a sannyasi. I mean, I'm joking, of course. No, but some people may think like that. No, I mean, this year, I'm 15 years as a sannyasi without engaging in any form of sexual abuse. So that basically is synonymous with me being pure devotee and not needing to transform any further. To give an example, some people may think like that. All right, I'm a senior devotee. I've been practicing for 25 years. I already know what this is about. No need for transformation. I mean, statu quo. I already established. I have my position, my reputation, my followers, my bank account, my dad. So I don't need anything. Some people may think like that, but so I'm saying all this again because you are asking also about obstacles getting in the way. Of course, there's lots of fear to what implies change or transformation, because we are fearful of new things because new things imply the death of all things, of all ways of understanding, of all ways of living. We are fearful about that. Most of us, I'm not saying everyone on the same degree, but in general, we are change unsettle us. We tend to look for non-change in many cases. And I understand, as I talk in my book, chaos and order, the two need to be there, not fully chaos, but not only order, it can become a dictatorship. So we need some challenging waves that invite us to transform. So that will be the beginning. So when you open a book like Radical Personalism, since this example you are quoting, yes, this is a book that, comes from a transformation that I went through. And by saying transformation, I'm not saying I'm an enlightened being or anything. There are so many transformations we are going through. So many micro enlightenments we are getting, ideally, on a daily basis, forever, nonstop. You can always be more enlightened. So it comes from a place of something that was deeply experienced by force of circumstances, we know, as you know, and I know. So in that sense, it's transformational. Because it's really written from that place. It's not written from other place. It's just like a testimony to certain very alive episodes that I have went through and the outcome of that, which came with that aliveness in my experience and in others' experience who read that as well. But again, if you read the book and one may be too overtly, attached to doing things in certain way and being convinced that those are the right ways, for whatever reason, I'm not stigmatizing that, you may not find very much of a transformation there, or you may find even a threat unconsciously, and you may not be willing to go through those pages. And again, that's why I'm saying, it's not everyone may need to read my first book, not everyone may need to read my second book either. Because sometimes I hear devotees, and I understand their enthusiasm, like, everyone should read this book. Everyone should be reading in the Gaudiya community, Radical Personalism. This is, and they are talking more from their personal experience and transformation. And I really celebrate that. And I'm humbled by that. And I feel so grateful by having been useful to create some inspiration. But at the same time, I remind myself to remain sober. Probably not everyone has to need to read that. No? In the sense, not everyone will take that and will find something useful because of their particular situation they may be in. And it's perfect. It's okay. I'm not demanding everyone should read my book. That's why in our tradition, before starting a book, and that's more like of a classical system of how Shastra has been written, is kind of, in the beginning of the book, you establish a few things, what the book is about, what's the main topic, the intention of the author, a few things. I won't go into the technicalities of that. And one of the points is also the adhikar of the reader. No? The eligibility of the one picking the book. So the reader, if you are picking the book, like for example, I don't know, in the Satsandarbha, Jiva Goswami says, the adhikar for reading the book is that you have to have Shraddha in Bhakti for Krishna. You have to have faith in Krishna Bhakti. So you are reading this book with the purpose of increasing your faith in Krishna Bhakti. If you don't have that faith, probably this book is not for you. No, so Jiva Goswami is trying also to, how to say, to help people not lose their time. No? in the sense that that book may not be useful for them at that stage. So in a similar way, we can render some more contemporary versions of that caution, so to say, or clarification. And okay, No, not everyone has to read this book or that book or this other book. Or maybe people themselves will realize that while going through their pages. So that's one thing. And in relation to, yeah, to take, if you are open to transformation, then I will say that that's the main thing in one sense, that one remains open to transformation. Before opening any book, before doing anything, you remain in that state. It's more like a lifestyle. Remain open to transformation. It's not just when facing a book, when facing a sadhu, but it's a lifestyle, because everything in our environment is promoting transformation. Everything is transforming. So to keep oneself into that lifestyle, and that can be a discipline in the beginning, that can be a daily reminder, that can be a, again, we have to be creative into what works better for us. But ideally, sadhu sangha, Hari Katha, listening, talking, sharing is all about that. It's all about keeping us in a place of transformation, keeping us into a place where we remind ourselves, become aware and remain aware of our need for constant growth, our need for constant change. So the quality of the sharing, the quality of the Hari Katha, the quality of the association, whatever, however you frame it, ideally has to be such that it keeps this ever-fresh spirit of what life is about, of what Krishna consciousness is about. So it's a constant reminder about how things are ever-fresh, ever-new, can always be attained on a deeper level. They're always evolving. So remaining in a mode of transformation becomes no longer an option. It's just how reality operates. So, but again, in the beginning, we may need constant reminders in what we hear about, what we read about, who we talk to, how we discipline our mind on a daily basis, reminders that we may need, notes you may need to write on the wall of your house, alarms you may need to put in your cell phone to remind you about that, how you address your prayer life, so many things. Again, here I'm not telling you how to do it in only one way. That's how it is, the final formula. But we have to do it to keep ourselves in that learning spirit, so to say. Srila Sri Maharaj will say, we are students forever. So that's the point, no? And then when we receive some information and we are in the spirit of transformation, automatically that information will be received as transformation, not as mere information. Because you are open to transformation. So if some information comes with a background of transformation itself, it will hit you as transformation, as transformational, not as merely informative. You follow? Someone wrote a book from a very transformed place, and you are willing to be transformed, and you meet that, you can imagine, no? Like the Bhagavatam, it said, it's written in Samadhi Bhasha, to use another expression in our tradition. Vyasadev composed the Bhagavatam in the language of Samadhi, basically said, in the language of trance, which is pretty transformational. You can imagine, Samadhi is something very transformational, especially devotional Samadhi. So Vyasadev, the Bhagavatam is written from that place. Every line, every verse is embedded of that spirit of ever-evolving transformation. So that's why so many lines in the Bhagavatam, Satyohri Diyabaru, Dites, Susrusvistat, Kritibis, Sakshanat, and so on. So many lines said, if you read the Bhagavatam properly, you hear it just once, you can just explode. You are totally transformed. Because it speaks about, this book was written from that place of profound transformational spirit. So even if you are not, and we are not mostly, on that same level of transformational experience, Samadhi, that Vyasa had, if at least we are open to transformation on some level, and you meet a work that is fully backed by transformation, that will create it. So I will say that's one of that will be the main thing I may like to emphasize as a reply to your question. Mm-hmm. Let's try to develop a whole lifestyle of transformation by proper company, by proper practices, by proper reminders, awareness. So, and we will get in touch with information and it will be transformative. Now, it always reminds me when once Srila Siddhar Maharaj, just to conclude with this, sometimes he was in his mat in Sri Chaitanya Sarasvati mat in Navadvip, and he will be reading the newspapers, not like just to become aware of certain what was going on in the world, so to say. There's a place for that. And Bhakti Sundar Govinda Maharaj will say, actually, what Guru Maharaj reads in the newspapers is Shastra. Because he's so transformed that even if you give him a not so much transformational text, he is so transformed that he will find in those texts something absolutely transformative. Well, on the contrary, if you are not willing to be transformed and you receive the most transformational text such as the Bhagavatam, your reading of it may not be better than reading a newspaper. No? Generally, we are not much transformed after reading a newspaper. We read it and we threw it in the garbage. That shows how much that paper transformed us. No, we take the newspaper and we throw it. So my point is to create a contrast. If you are really in a place of transformation, willing to that, or transform yourself, even if you cross an ordinary text, let's give an example, it won't be ordinary. Somehow your own transformation will tell you to find some deep gems in between the lines.
And Maharaj, that was beautiful. And you also talk about that in relationship to communicating with others by allowing ourselves to be changed.
Yeah.
And that must come by a certain way of listening, of receiving and opening up to the exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something we all need to learn because we all are in our own little orbit. So I'm finding that even with difficult family members, I'm opening up more and we're connecting better.
That's
because
great.
I have a kind of a different mindset. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. The Bhagavatam itself again shows this example of the 24 gurus showing we should be able to learn from everyone, even inanimate beings, animals, nature. A prostitute, no?
Very exciting.
Bilba Mangala Thakur offering praise at the beginning of Krishna Karnamrita to Chintamani, his Siksha Guru. She was a prostitute. So again, we find that in our tradition, this invitation to be willing to learn from everyone and everyone, as you say, and leave our private orbits. The tendency is that, again, tendency is narrow-mindedness, is fear, is so-called stability in whatever we already know and we can control. Still, we are fearful about what we cannot control, what lies beyond our full grasp. But that's Maya, no? As I mentioned, radical personalism. Maya means that which can be measured. And that which can be measured basically means that which can be controlled. So as long as we keep that stance, it's a way of what we say, you are in Maya. Of course, we are all in Maya in one level or another because we are still addicted to measuring things, controlling things, and remaining around those things, situations that we can, that are predictable, basically, that do not represent that much of a challenge for us. So to transcend Maya means basically to transcend that tendency and expose gradually more and more to this more nuanced, dynamic venues of life where we are able to be transformed. We are willing to be transformed and therefore able to be transformed by so many things that we never thought could transform us in a positive way, no? So, yeah, it's one of the many rebirths we need to go through in this lifetime.
The
so thank you so much.
the last thing is that, and Prabhupada called his purports his spiritual ecstasies.
Yeah.
And he read them because he didn't, he just came through him.
Yeah.
And he wanted to see what he said.
Yeah. And that's how it should continue. That's parampara. It's a living thing, passed from one to another, and it's in constant growth and expansion. That's the nature of the movement. I was reminded the other day, I read this quote from the Bible when Jesus say to his disciples, you will continue with my work and you will be able even to do greater things than me. That's interesting. Huh? Like implying this nature of ever growing and ever evolving contribution in what we may call parampara. So that's also our duty today here now as members of this beautiful tradition. So thank you so much, Risangi, for your questions and contributions and comments. And thank you to all of you for being present. I'll be concluding here since today in the evening we had another meeting here, last program in Shyamashram and some meeting with some friends since almost last day here. I'm looking forward to meet with you next week. And of course, not only next week, but hopefully in many ways, many times. So keep in touch. Sri Mahashivaratri ki jai, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar ji ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Govinda ji ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Paramananda Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru.